Welcome, everyone. This is the Rotary Club of Worldwide Impact, and we're excited to share our mission and the work we do as part of Rotary International with all of you today. My name is Kelly, and I'm your host for today's program. Rotary International is a global network of 1.4 million neighbors, friends, leaders, and problem solvers in more than 46,000 clubs, all united in the common goal of making a positive impact in our communities and worldwide. As a Rotary Club, we approach every conversation as an opportunity to learn and grow together. Our goal is to connect with and hear from fascinating and inspiring speakers, often with a message focused on the power of ideas to change lives and ultimately the world, and bring you a little bit of inspiration that allows you to think about how you can make a difference as well. Today, we are honored to have with us Joshua Ross, also known as Josh. Joshua studied finance and accounting. He completed his chartered financial analyst designation in 2014. And in early 2010, he joined Watermark Funds Management as the third employee in the investment team and consistently remained one of the top performers over a 7-year period. Joshua resigned from Watermark in March 2017 to create Humanitix, a charity which is disrupting the events industry by turning booking fees into sustainable funding for domestic violence shelters, the environment, Indigenous education, improving health, and alleviating poverty. To date, Humanitix has given over $2.5 million to its education programs and is growing rapidly. To date, Humanitix has offices in Sydney, Auckland, and Denver. They won the Google Impact Challenge in 2018. This is a global competition that looks for the best tech ideas to change the world for good. And its main partner is the Atlassian Foundation. Josh has joined us for a fireside chat to share more about the journey from working in the investment industry to launching a social enterprise. So sit back, relax, and get ready to be inspired. Thank you for joining us today, Josh.
Thanks, Kelly, and thanks for including me on the show. Appreciate it.
Great. Well, in the introduction, we shared a little bit about what Humanitix is. Perhaps you could elaborate a bit more. What is it and what does it offer?
Yeah, sure. So Humanitix, it's a registered charity, but it operates a ticketing platform for events. So people selling tickets to 10,000 people person music festivals or small gala dinners or 10 person yoga workshops. They need an online platform to sell tickets to their audience. And so we provide that software and we charge booking and credit card fees as every ticketing platform does. But the key point of difference is that all our profits fund different predominantly children's charities with a focus around education. And the other nice part is nonprofits and charities can use our platform at our sustainable cost price. So thousands and thousands of charities use us around the world, including a lot of Rotary clubs in Australia, New Zealand, and increasingly in America as well, which are our core markets at present.
Yeah, that's a great summary. I did notice, on your website, there was a logo of Rotary on there. So I figured there's a lot of participation and use cases for Rotary clubs within Australia. The name itself is really clever, the combination of humanity and the short form of tickets. How did that come about?
There's a funny story behind that, but I'll give you the honest story. So Adam and McCurdy, my co-founder, we'd been working on this idea for about 9 months and we'd built a prototype and we're about to launch what's called a minimal viable product, which is to test the idea. And he had an engineering background, I had a finance background. So neither of us are brand or marketing guys. And so my ex-girlfriend at the time was coming up with all types of funny names and messaging them to my co-founder. And some of them, you know, were pretty tongue in cheek, but nestled among them was Humanitix. And then he didn't really respond. He just laughed. A few weeks later, he called me at very early in the morning, like it hit me in a dream. It was Humanitix. And I got so excited and I didn't know about my ex-girlfriend's messages. And so later that night, I'm with my girlfriend and I'm telling her, Adam's come up with the name. It's Humanitix. She's like, oh, that's a great name. Wait a minute, that rings a bell. And she pulled up her phone. So we sent him a screenshot of sorry, Adam, you didn't come up with the name. She did. And so, yeah, that's how we came up with it. We were literally about to launch in a week. We still didn't have a name or a logo. So, usually people start with the brand and the name and then get into the meat of the idea. But we were the opposite.
Wow. Yeah, what a funny story. but it is very catchy. Yeah. And that's great. Thanks for sharing that. You spent the early part of your career working at a hedge fund. So what made you decide to pivot your career and completely go in a different direction and create Humanitics?
Yeah, I have to backpedal it. When I was at university, I read a book called Banker to the Poor, which is by Muhammad Yunus. He founded Grameen Bank. And for those who don't know, Grameen Bank was the first microfinance nonprofit. So there were microloans in low-income countries to raise women predominantly, but their families as well, out of poverty. And I was blown away by this idea where, and the social entrepreneur that had taken banking, an industry that's notorious for screwing over poor people, and turning it into something really good to lift people out of poverty. And so and my co-founder also read that book, and he was pretty inspired. So we were kind of grappling at what we can do in Australia, because $2 loans don't go very far in Sydney. It's a pretty expensive city. What can we do with our time on this planet that can have an impact like that? And we're both drawn to social impact for a range of values reasons. But neither of us had a good idea. And we both recognized that we had to get like industry experience and a skill in the world, because you have to be able to give something to an idea. And so he went into engineering and management consulting. I went into finance. I never intended to stay in finance. I got lucky enough to land a job at a pretty good hedge fund at the time. And that was going to allow me to save up the money and help create something like Humanitics. And so it was really just a short-term trade of my time for financial freedom, so that I could spend the majority of my life doing the things that I was most passionate about. Sometimes you can align money with passion, but more often than not, and that definitely wasn't the case for me in a hedge fund. It was it's a good place to learn, build a network, and give myself a little bit of buffer so that I could, for the first few years of Humanitics, Adam and I earned nothing. So we needed that financial freedom.
So it really was like a launching pad, but yeah, never your end goal. It was just a place to start. So what skills do you think have helped you and your co-founder the most in this new career? What transferable skills do you think that you learned from your past career?
Yeah, so Adam's experience was more relevant at the start because he had engineering and tech experience. And, this idea doesn't work unless you have a great platform. So he actually left his job first and went full-time on Humanitics. And we shared my salary in a handshake. So I literally just get my paycheck after tax and send him half of it. We did that for about 16 months, and I'd work weeknights and weekends with him. From the hedge fund, I mean, look, if you can cut it in like investment banking or hedge funds and not get fired, or even just, you have to have a really good work ethic because it's incredibly cutthroat, and people are super money hungry, so everyone's working really hard. So the biggest skill set I brought across was actually just the work ethic. People often, if they do something for 5 or 10 years time, and I felt this, so I'm speaking from my own experience, but having spoken to people, it's often shared, is you get quite scared to step out of what you've been doing because it starts to become your identity. You start to think, what the hell could I do in another organization? I've been doing auditing for 7 years. I've been doing investing for 7 years. Like, it's very non-tangible skills. But what you find is if you're in an industry or you're a person with a strong work ethic, that's all you need in a startup. There's no specialization of skills. So all you got to do is work out what the next solution to the next problem is. And so just bringing that energy and that commitment was really powerful. Also, industry analysis was quite useful because when we were picking out industries that were ripe for disruption, like my whole day job was looking at different business models. And so I understood, we modeled out ticketing at the start to say, look, this is an industry ripe for disruption for these reasons. And that commercial acumen around like ticketing wasn't random. We came to it for good reason. We wanted to create a tech social enterprise. So that was quite useful. And it also gave me a pretty good network. So about 2 years in, we did raise some money philanthropically. And having an investment background definitely helped with that. But I don't use my CFA on a day-to-day. It's 3 years of my life I'll never get back. So
it's still good to have. No, that's really good. That's really good career advice. I'm sure like that resonates with a lot of people in the audience today. So starting something new is never easy. What are some of the challenges you face while building this new enterprise?
Yeah, well, the first one I kind of alluded to before was just like believing in myself, because I was just a finance guy. Like, all I knew how to do was spreadsheets and investing. And so like, I was very anxious about leaving to be in a startup. And my co-founder was really supportive in that. And without him, I probably wouldn't have had the courage to step out. But then once you step out and you do something new, you realize no one knows what they're doing. And it's absolutely fine as long as you've got a good work ethic. The second hardest part was, you know, we left good paying jobs, moved back home with our parents. We were 26, 27 at the time, and earned nothing for about 18 months, and then on minimum wage for another year. And we weren't building equity value in Humanitix because there's no shareholders. It's a charity. So that was quite mentally hard because all around you, your friends and every peers, you know, putting mortgages on places and moving ahead in life, at least financially. And so that was, you know, mentally quite tough. The third element was just adjusting to a workplace that was very different to what I was used to. The hedge fund was cutthroat. There were some nice people working in it, but it was, the leadership style was nothing like anything I wanted to spend the rest of my life in. And so that was an interesting adjustment, like working with people in a different dynamic where it's a lot more informal, a lot more friendly, a lot more human. You don't have to put on a mask when you go into the office and pretend you don't have a personality. So that was really refreshing and nice. I mean, I'm kind of talking about the big adjustments, not really answering your question. The hardest part was the mental jump, like just letting go of the fear of the unknown and backing yourself to create something when you can't see how you can be useful to it.
Yeah, there's a lot of uncertainty, but at the end of the day, you just need to believe in yourself and know that you'll get through everything. And also that you mentioned, like, sort of comparing yourself to where you are in life with your friends and family. But I guess ultimately, as long as you're pursuing something that brings you happiness and enjoy, then you know you're doing the right thing.
Yeah, and we de-risked it because we had good corporate experience. So like if it didn't work, cool. So we dusted a year. But if you go to most employees and say, look, I've got 7 years at one company, then I tried my hand at something entrepreneurial, didn't work out, realized it's not for me, but I'm clearly a hard worker and it was, you know, like I've got initiative, like you're totally employable. I think a lot of people freak out on the all or nothing, but you know, as long as you do it responsibly, I think it looks quite good to your next employer if you do have to retreat from the idea. So yeah, talking that through with my co-founder, doing it in a sensible, measured way. I think I have a lot of respect, but I think it's a lot harder for someone who hasn't had some experience and something to fall back on to go out there. So like a lot of entrepreneurs at 18, 19, 20, like it's a lot scarier, I think, for them.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. You have something to fall back on. So there's a little bit more security there.
Totally.
So yeah, the Humanitix, a social enterprise, is disrupting this huge ticketing industry and you're seeing a lot of growth. How have your competitors responded?
They haven't really. They just keep doing their thing, which is charging excessively high fees, terrible customer service. And if you've been following the Ticketmaster news in America, pissing off half the population. So touch wood, they don't really respond. But we're big in Australia and New Zealand, but globally we're not big. So I think we're a fly on the wall still.
I thought maybe like besides Ticketmaster, maybe something like Eventbrite, if they're also sort of looking towards this model of like donating a portion of the fees, but maybe not. Maybe it has not.
I mean, I'm sure they'll do something like that eventually, but it'll be tokenistic. So, you know, we are more profitable than they are in terms of our profit margins and all of it's flowing into social impact. They, like many companies do, might end up giving a cent of a cent to something. And that would be nice if they did that. But it's not going to fundamentally change our value proposition with our audience. So, they're a listed company. You know, they were venture capital backed, like the most ruthless investors in the world backing them. So if they ever do anything social, it'll just be to grow the bottom line, I imagine, not, you know, buying corporate license.
Right, yeah. No, that's fair.
It's pretty hard for a listed company with, like I've seen it on the other side of the fence, like fund managers meet with management quarterly and they make a decision after that meeting if it's a public share, which Eventbrite is, and it's, is this going up or down? I sell it if it's going down, I buy it if it's going up. So there's no long-term investment in the company at that point. They don't care about the staff necessarily, the investors. So anything they do is just based on their meeting with, you know, the fund of funds or whoever's allocating them capital. So the incentive structure's got nothing to do with social impact. And yeah, but sometimes social impact is good for marketing. So maybe they'll, you know, like every business that gets big does something.
Right. But like you said, it's more like a token donation. Oh, it's not really at its core the way it is for Humanitics.
If we were Eventbrite size, we'd be giving $60 million a year to our projects per annum. So it'd be one of the biggest foundations in the world in terms of distributions per annum. You know, Eventbrite might do something nice and give $1 million to charity next year, but like it's a fundamentally different model.
Right. Not too long ago, I was watching an episode of John Oliver, and he hosts The Last Week Tonight, and he did an episode on the ticketing industry. And so what I learned was that there's these exclusive contracts that exist between large ticketing companies and venues. So this prohibits some artists from performing there if they don't want to use that ticketing provider. So it's been really hard for artists to enact change. So how could Humanitics further disrupt this industry?
There's a couple of reasons why you wouldn't want to use an incumbent ticketing platform at a venue. One might be because their fees are 20, 30% of the ticket price, or 50 to 100% they sometimes are. So we charge super modest fees. We make a good margin, but you know, we went after ticketing because I was making super profits. So if we do contract with a venue, no one's unhappy to use us because their patrons aren't getting ripped off. So like Pearl Jam famously tried to take Ticketmaster to court because they were trying to do tickets for their fans, which are often from lower socioeconomic backgrounds, and the fees are just ridiculous. And so, you know, the perverse outcomes where, I don't know if it was exactly this, but like the booking fee can equal the ticket price. Now with Humanitics, it's like a couple of percent, and that includes the credit card fees. So you buy a $100 ticket, it becomes maybe $104 at checkout. So they have no problem with working with us, because you can't get it cheaper anywhere else. Like there's actually a cost to providing the service. So that's how we're disrupting it, that and the rest of our model, which is really good customer service, amazing software. But yeah, mainly it's just about being a human ticketing platform. Like we're not out to monopolize a venue and then charge whatever the hell we want because we've got a 10-year exclusive contract and it's the only venue in town that can fit this big an audience, which is the old ticketing model, which is everyone is sick of. Yeah.
Yeah. So hopefully over time, this will change. I think it seems like more artists are speaking up too. So hopefully that helps. Yeah. And yeah, maybe if there are partnerships in the future, that could only further elevate Humanitics.
Yeah, well, we're growing really quickly because people are sick of it. But I don't know. It's kind of funny. Like it's bittersweet. Like for those who don't know, in the US Senate, there's been like politicians getting up talking about, you know, the Taylor Swift concert and what an outrage this is for the country and consumers, et cetera. It's like, I'm really happy to see that as the co-founder of Humanitics, because it's good for us because we're an ethical alternative that fixes those problems. But at the same time, I'm like, there are bigger issues in the world than a bunch of Taylor Swift fans struggling to get tickets. Like, come on, politicians, like focus on the real problems in the world. But I get it, as a politician, you want to get up and say that because like half the country is going to vote for you if they associate you with their favorite artist. So it's just politics. I don't think they really care about the consumer.
Yeah.
That's a sad reality. It's like healthcare, education, all these fundamental problems in society. And we're talking about Taylor, like little Shelley, who didn't get a ticket to the Taylor Swift concert. What an outrage.
Yeah, but
talk about priorities and the limited airtime we've got at Senate.
It does catch headlines, that's for sure.
Yeah.
So I noticed that many projects or partners supported by Humanitics focus on improving health, environmental initiatives, and supporting education and literacy, which seems like the biggest pillar. These goals actually overlap really nicely with some of Rotary's areas of focus, such as maternal and child health, the environment, which was newly added recently, and basic education and literacy. So I'm curious, what are some projects or partnerships that speak to you personally?
Yeah, I mean, one of my favorites that we partner with is Room to Read, and they focus on literacy and life skill programs for young girls. And I know a bunch of Rotary clubs fundraise for them as well. And there's just such good evidence behind the efficacy of it and the downstream benefits to the family. when a young girl is able to stay in school, get an education, get agency over her life, and not be forced down paths which aren't conducive to breaking cycles of poverty. And it's also really good for the environment. There's a lot of the United Nations ranks young girls' education as one of the best ways to help the environment, because you have a more sustainable family when, you know, there's parts of the world that you might get married off at 13 and end up with more kids than you can afford, and therefore you're, you know, a cycle of poverty is emerging. So the other cool thing about literacy programs is you can kill illiteracy in a generation, and it has been rapidly dropping around the world. Like, it's quite possible in the next 5-10 years that illiteracy will only be a problem in war zones, where it's temporary, hopefully. Because if you raise someone to read and write, there's no way in hell they don't teach that to their kids. I mean, just think about it. Like, you're not going to let that happen. And so globally, like in India, illiteracy is not really a problem anymore. That's very different to 25 years ago. I'm not saying it's completely dead, but the improvement is dramatic, and there's not many social issues that you can kill in a generation, to say. Don't quote me on that line, might be misinterpreted. But yeah.
No, that's an interesting point. Yeah, it's a skill that you learn, and you'll continue to teach it to others. That's a good point. So I noticed that you have a lot of projects in areas where you have presence. So in Australia, New Zealand, and Room to Read is it's available global. It has chapters globally, but I think there's a big presence in the US where you've expanded to. Is that intentional?
Yeah, so Room to Read, they fundraise in wealthy countries, but all their operations on the front line are in low-income countries. But in Australia, for example, we have a partnership with an Indigenous charity called Yallery, and they focus on Aboriginal education initiatives. In America, we partner with Code.org, and they teach computer science to disadvantaged, to children, but with a focus on disadvantaged and minority groups. And so a lot of our profits are flowing into low-income countries where, you know, the dollar can go a lot further. But in the countries where we've got a presence, we also have domestic projects we partner with. And so it depends on how you view the world, whether you see a life as a life or you're more fix my backyard before caring about the rest of the world. And both arguments have merits. But when you look at the scale of global philanthropy, sadly, very little is going to the poorest people. And so we shift most of our profits into low-income countries because of that. We see life as a life. So while I'm Australian and I care about Australia, I don't value an Australian life more than a life in sub-Saharan Africa or other parts of the world where, you know, the reality is it's much tougher.
Mm. Yeah, no, thanks for clarifying that point about Room to Read. So it's just like the chapters of where they operate and fundraise, but yeah, all the
yeah, so they got an office in Sydney, but it's like a fundraising manager and a marketing manager or something. It's all in like India, Nepal, sub-Saharan Africa, South Africa, places like that.
Very good. Thanks for clarifying.
No worries.
Rotary is very keen on supporting projects that are sustainable. So we'd love to hear more about the vetting process. So we've talked a little bit about Room to Read, the organizations in Australia, but how do you go about making those selections?
Yeah, so our view is like there's too much duplication in the charity sector. So like my dad has prostate cancer, therefore I create the Josh's Prostate Cancer Foundation and I fundraise for the prostate cancer and cool, another 20,000 in accounting costs a year. Maybe I get some of them pro bono, but like that happens way too much in the charity sector. And so there are amazing institutions out there looking at education projects globally, doing frontline research, impact monitoring and evaluation. And we're a scaling tech charity startup thing, which, we don't have the additional resources to send teams through Africa working out what's working on the ground and what's not. So our strategy has always been to partner with the smartest foundations we can find, who are also consistent with our values and are supportive of our growth and understand our model, and team up on their research rather than duplicating it. Like me and Adam don't sit down at the end of the year and review applications and say, oh, that one sounds nice, let's give X dollars to that. Like that armchair philanthropy approach, which is still really nice and does good in the world, but does a lot less good than like evidence-based research behind projects. And so the Atlassian Foundation, and for those who don't know, Atlassian's Australia's largest tech company. They're the equivalent of a Microsoft. They're super successful. They have a hundreds of millions dollar big foundation, and it's all focused on education in low-income countries. And so we team up with them. They do really good work. They're very well respected, and a few other partners. And that's how we narrow it down to what we want to fund. But we're not duplicating the cost structure of that, which we think would be, you know, this year we'll give $3 to $4 million to our projects. For us to replicate what they're doing would eat up all the donation we'd give to do it well. Because it's easy to do it not well. It's really hard to actually do it well.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense to leverage the expertise of the Atlassian Foundation, where they're already conducting this research. They have the resources to do it. And you're already partners. So it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, so our approach is to sense check they're doing it well and then piggyback.
Mm. So Humanitex has been very successful in the Australian market. Sometimes there's cultural differences as you expand to other markets. So I'm very curious to know, is there a difference in user behavior or feedback you noticed from event organizers in Sydney versus Denver or Auckland?
Not really, to be honest. Like, it's a bit like Microsoft Word. Australians use it in the same way Americans use it, as I imagine the same way Europeans use the product. There's not really a cultural element to Microsoft Word or Excel. It's very similar in ticketing software. Like, our clients often don't speak to us. They just create a free account, build their event, and get going. And if they need help, they'll contact us. But a discount code is the same thing in Australia as it is in the UK or Germany or wherever it might be. And so interestingly, I think the social impact like framing is actually much more hot in America than it is in Australia or New Zealand. Mm. And so we're growing here much quicker than we did in Australia and New Zealand. And I think it's because there's, I don't know American culture back to front, but it seems like they're screaming out for ethical alternatives more than Australians are.
I think that's really interesting.
A factor of the politics in the country, and you know, the news here is definitely more negative. So I think maybe the culture is like, but Americans are, I think, I don't know exactly, but they're one of the most philanthropic countries in the world from an individual, not from a government perspective. And so I know they give a lot more than Australians do philanthropically. I think Australians volunteer more, but yeah. So, you know, there's a lot of very generous people in America and a lot of wealth here. And so it's a different mindset to Australia in that perspective.
No, I have heard of that statistic before, that Americans on an individual basis are some of the top donors in the world. So maybe they're gravitating towards something good because of all the negative news, as you mentioned. And this is a way where they don't necessarily need to change their consumer behavior, but they're able to have more of an impact if they just change providers or use a different service.
And I think there's it's a much more Christian country than most other countries in the world that are, you know, OECD countries. And I think that plays a factor as well. But I know from a government perspective, I think the Scandinavian countries are the most generous. So in terms of foreign aid and things like that. But that is not my area of expertise. So I'll stop before I say something wrong.
So inclusivity is really important for many organizations today. Maybe you could tell us a bit more about the innovative work that Humanitex has been conducting around event accessibility for people with disabilities. And perhaps if you have a personal story, you could share it with us. That would be great too.
Yeah, sure. So I'll just step back from Humanitex for a second and give a bit of context to it, because to me, it wasn't obvious 5 years ago, and I'm sure for a lot of people it isn't. But when someone say, I'll talk about vision impairments, but this is much wider than that, but that's the easiest to understand if you don't have a disability yourself, is if you're blind, legally blind, you have a really hard time navigating the internet. So what you'd probably have on your smartphone is a text-to-voice reader, a screen reader, that will translate to you what's on a website and allow you to navigate it. That's really important, because depending on what part of the world you're in, you might get some support. It might be a digital service that you can pay for, that you get a few hours of someone who can help you do your online banking and things like that. Or you might have a carer that can help you with that, or a relative, or you might have to do it on your own. And a lot of websites aren't built to be compatible with screen readers. And so when you go to a website, if you hit text to voice, it may not capture everything. It may totally misconstrue the meaning of the website because there's imagery and words are in the imagery. And so there's a whole bunch of factors there that make it really hard for legally blind people to navigate the internet. And that's really important from a social inclusion, from a practical perspective of life administration, from connecting with people. I mean, so much connection now happens online. Look at what we're doing right now. And so in the events space, pretty much none of the ticketing platforms are playing ball. So there's web accessibility disability charities that their mission is to get more websites web accessible. It's not that expensive to do the work to do it. It's actually quite cheap. There's a lot of resources there now, the standards. It's not hard to do. And so there's a group in America called Mobility. They're one of the leaders in the world at web accessibility. And it was pretty cool. When we entered America, they actually reached out to us to say, hey, thank you so much for expanding here. We've been watching you in Australia. You're the only accessible registration platform. We've been lobbying the for-profit incumbents for over a decade. They'd even tried to raise money from philanthropists to become to build an accessible registration platform, because events are like central to how people get together and community participation, social inclusion. And even for their events, they were having to use, I believe, Eventbrite, which was not web accessible for them. And so they're preaching it, but not able to practice it for their own events. They couldn't raise philanthropic money to do it because there's very little philanthropy for tech ideas. It's just foundations aren't set up to generally support them. So they couldn't do that. So they were so excited we came into America, and they're now one of our partners. And they wrote a whole piece on it. But yeah, we discovered about 5 years ago that people with disabilities often giving up attending live events because it's a nightmare. They can't get the information they need. Event organizers don't necessarily need to know how to cater. So like, you'll get someone in a wheelchair, go to an event because it says wheelchair accessible if they're a guest speaker, and maybe they're an inspirational speaker. Then they get invited up on stage in front of everyone, but the stage isn't wheelchair accessible, just the venue is for the main entrance. And so like, there's just all these stories where like people give up. They're like, it was so embarrassing. I was a guest speaker. I couldn't get on stage. People had to lift me up. It was like in front of a room of 600 people. Like, it's just a horrible experience. It's not because the event organizer is unkind or doesn't care. It's just, it's a niche area that if you're not affected by it, often you don't know how to cater for it. And so we've built our platform to be web accessible, which our event organizers don't even know. Like some of them know, but like, they don't need to do anything for that to just work with screen readers. And, you know, it's built with all that in mind. But then we go further, and there's a module on the back end that we built with Vision Australia and the Australian Network on Disability and a few different disability groups. We did design workshops with people from varying disabilities to find out what's the critical information they need to have the confidence to attend the events. So there's all these different layers of accessibility that we've built into the platform that allow for that. And we're not done. Like, we'll never be able to solve the problem completely, but we've made a meaningful improvement on what the status quo was. So that's quite cool. Yeah.
I'm pretty passionate about it,
as you can tell.
No, I think it's fantastic because it's not something that I had thought about. But then when I was reading about it, I thought, wow, you're continuing to innovate and you're addressing this really important need. And you want all people to be able to use your platform. So inclusivity should be top of mind. And hopefully this is something that can be replicated on other websites too, and just to make the web more accessible in general.
Yeah, well, our broader vision is how can we use technology to solve social problems? It's such a powerful force. And so we want non-charitable tech companies that are structured as charities that exist to solve social problems, because like, imagine how powerful that would be for the world. But you need an economic engine inside of it, because you need to be able to pay for developers and software development. And you just can't do that in the current philanthropic paradigm. Like, if I was to go to any of the big foundations out there, Rotary, you name it, like whoever it is, like there's just no mandates for like, yeah, hire software developers and build software to solve social problems. So like the ticketing is just the first step on that journey of like, how do we solve social problems with technology, which is why the accessibility side is so important to us, because it's an application of software to solve a problem, as opposed to profits from booking fees funding frontline charities. If that makes sense. Mm-hmm.
Is that part of your bigger vision in the future? Like, as you continue to grow, you're going to move in this direction?
Yeah, absolutely. Just imagine if Amazon had no shareholders and its mission was to solve social problems, like save the Amazon rainforest. It would have been fixed 10 years ago. So like we want to have tech giants that don't have shareholders that just exist to solve social problems. You just can't fund that out of philanthropy. It's just not there. So you need to be a master of your own destiny and have a social enterprise model. But yeah, it's totally our vision.
Great. Yeah, we're looking forward to seeing what you have planned in the future. We'll definitely be following along. So I know it's been a really great conversation. I think maybe we have to start wrapping up, but I did want to ask you a fun question. Not to say the questions before weren't fun, but like a very playful question. So I found three upcoming events on your site, and I'll read them out to you. And it would be great if you could choose one that you would like to attend and tell us why. So the first is a class on latte art happening in Colorado, so you could still go. Second is the art of tabla, immersive finger drumming experience in New York. And the third is a Mardi Gras after party cruise in Australia.
Cool. Well, that's hilarious. There's a lot of wacky stuff on our platform. Like you think of a niche subculture and it's on our platform running some events. But I was a barista for 7 years, so I already know how to do latte art, so I'll pass on that one. I did try and learn the djembe in Dharamshala in India, and I couldn't get my head around the other drums they had, so I'll pass on that one. So the Mardi Gras event will get me back to Sydney, so I'll take that. Sydney's got one of the biggest Mardi Gras in the world, so you know, a lot of people just go to it. You don't have to be gay. It's just a really fun time if you're into like, anyway, I probably wouldn't go to that. I'd probably pick the drumming bit, but that one gets me back to Sydney, so.
Another thing to look forward to when you go back. Well, thank you, Josh. Yeah. That was a wonderful chat we had. So I would love to move on to the question and answer period now. So sure. If anyone does have a question, please raise your hand by clicking on the reactions icon in the webinar controls toolbar. It's at the bottom of your screen, or you can send it through to the chat. Joanne, yeah, please
go ahead. Thank you. Ross, you really are something.
Thanks.
I took copious notes because I'm trying to find out how work a way out that I can make a part of my income percentage wise be added onto by my clients or companies that I work for, and find a innovative way to affect social change by offering constant movement of money toward organizations that fund, and my interest is children and girls and women across the globe. One of the reasons why I know they've heard this before, Pat and Raquel, get this paperwork in so I can join your club. I'm really busy, but that's really not an excuse. I enjoyed this presentation because you said something that I believe is absolutely essential. So I'm in America, so I do my job in America, and I don't have any foreign clients at the moment, but you said people are sick of it. And what you were talking about was the framework between what I call money chasers. Just get the money as much as you can, as if somehow that's the goal to so many people who are looking at social intervention through the use of good work beyond Rotary. I think people are sick of it. If I'm going to go to an event, I'd like to offer several tickets to young people or the people that would be appropriate for that event that don't have the money. So you kind of think the way I think, and believe me, I'm way older than you are. Like way older. I really enjoyed it. Josh, you just keep on rowing down the river.
Thank you for the support. Yeah, thanks for the kind feedback.
Cool. Thanks, Joanne. Pat, you have a question.
Yeah, kind of inspired by Raquel. As a Rotary Club, we do events. Some of those, or most of those events, are free. You work percentage, but why? So,
what could it's free for free events. I should have said that at the start. Yeah. So there's no charge if it's a free or comp ticket or anything like that.
So, and we could
It is only in English at the moment. We will be rolling out more languages over the next few years, but step at a time.
That sounds good.
I mean to cut you off.
Yeah. No problem. That sounds good. I was thinking, hey, if we start charging low fees, there's an extra percentage on top of that, and that could be flowing through as well. So that's a good thing. And another question I had, but that's more as a regular event visitor and being tired of being squeezed off. Are there venues or acts or events you would not support with your platform, and why?
I think anything promoting hate we'd take down. That's anything spreading, it's a hard one to answer because it's also a hard one to police at our scale. We just don't, we're still an early stage startup. We got under 50 people. So we're not one of these, $100 billion tech companies that has unlimited resources. I think the main one's hate. If it was promoting violence or hatred, we'd take it down if the community reported it back to us, or if we picked it up through the screens that we do have internally. So far, so good. I think part of the problem, we haven't had problems so far, because think about it, if you're a neo-Nazi and you want to put up a hatred event, you're not going to use a platform that its profits go into funding mainly children of color's education. You're going to self-select to another platform. So we haven't had that problem. And touch wood, we won't. We don't mean to, we try and stay out of politics and religion, we don't weigh into the conversation. So we have atheists and Christians and Muslims and everything in between using our platform. And, it's kind of universal. Children's education is, I'm yet to find a group that doesn't believe in that. So it's not we haven't had to be police. We're not serving up, we're not targeting people with events. So we're not responsible for pushing content. It's more like the Microsoft Word analogy, where anyone can use Microsoft Word to create their own documents. People can create their own events. If we ever plug an event in our newsletter, we're going to be very careful about the event we choose, that it's consistent with our values. But we're not like a Google or a Facebook, which is spreading stuff to its audience and choosing what it spreads through its algorithm. So we've got a bit of a different lens there, at least at this level of scale. That makes sense.
Thank you so much. Yeah, perfect.
Yeah.
Josh, I have another question. So I noticed that Humanitix has won several awards. Is there one that really sticks out for you that has that is really important to you, or has set the Humanitix on a certain path that really kickstarted things, or just is very memorable?
Yeah. You mentioned in the intro, but Google run that competition for tech ideas that can change the world. And we won that in 2018. It was a game changer for us because it gave us significant prize money, exposure, and the backing of such a big brand, even though it's through their foundation, not through the business. It gave us a lot of credibility when we were still 10 of us working from my co-founder's parents' place, super back bootstrapping, to get that award. And it gave us $1 million prize money. So suddenly we could employ more software developers and go from a cute idea to a serious idea from a product perspective. And so that was definitely in terms of trajectory and game changing, that was the big one. But actually the one I personally love the most is New South Wales is the biggest state in Australia. It has Sydney in it and a few other cities. The Premier of New South Wales gave a social enterprise award as one of her awards she gives every year, and Humanitix won it. And that was a really cool one because A, it's our home state, but also it was a recognition of the government, of the value of social enterprise to society. And it's very much an emerging ecosystem, the social enterprise ecosystem. It's kind of not included in policy. It's not really thought about in most of the world. And so that was for me personally, I think it's a big piece of the puzzle to solving the world's problems. It's not going to solve all of them, but it's got such potential to solve problems. So that's the one I'm personally most proud of.
Yeah, that's great to get that recognition from your home state.
Yeah.
All right. Well, if, oh, sorry, I haven't, we have another question that's come through. What were the main challenges at the start of Humanitix, and what is next? Are there any upcoming projects in the next couple of years?
Yeah, sure. So the first question being, you know, what was hardest at the start? I talked about it before with the mental step out of what's comfortable and consistent in an income. Building a technology charity, like, me and Adam weren't millionaires, so we always knew that if this worked, we'd need money to scale, because no tech platform's profitable in the first few years. And it was really hard to find philanthropists to fund the idea, because, you know, most philanthropy is emotional. So, like, you know, fortunately, not many people have died from ticketing. So there's not many foundations set up for ticketing. So, like, everyone was like, great idea, but that's not within our mandate, so we can't help you. And so we found some very innovative, outside the box thinking philanthropists, but that took 3-4 years. And so we almost couldn't scale, not because the idea wasn't working, but because we couldn't access the growth capital as a charity. So that was also the hardest part. And sorry, the second question was, what's next in the next couple of years? Any big plans? So I'd like to say in the next, like, we're already working on being present in Europe, so that event organizers can use us in Europe. And so that's a big project over the next few years. We've come into America about 18 months ago. It's going really well, like super well, well ahead of where we thought we'd be, which is very exciting. This is the biggest market in the world for booking fees. Americans get ripped off worse than anywhere else in the world when it comes to buying tickets. So there's a lot of good to be done here for our model. And so, you know, if we're giving 3 to 4 million a year now in Australia, which is 25 million people in New Zealand, if we get this right in America, it's going to be like $40 million a year going to these projects and not costing anyone anything extra. So it's really accretive to the world of philanthropy. It's not just, you know, a new charity that raises money here, which takes from charity B over there. So that's kind of our big goal the next few years, is nailing the US expansion, because we'll roll out into Europe, but, like, we won't see the fruits of that till probably 5 years from now. But America will hopefully start to see the fruits of in the next 2 to 3 years. So that's kind of the, and then on a medium term to long term view, we'd like to offer other technology products that solve social problems. So, you know, ticketing is not the end game. Again, Amazon's not exactly the ethical idea that we want to put ourselves next to, but, like, if you think of how Amazon started, it started with books, but look what it does now, it does everything. So, like, we want to have a suite of technology products that, you know, maybe this one fixes education, maybe this one fixes the environment, maybe this one fixes mental health issues, like different services, and disrupt different industries that are notorious, like the ticketing industry is, for good.
Great. Yeah, we're really excited for what's to come, especially with expansion in Europe, since a lot of us are based in Europe. John, I know you have a question. Maybe we can save it for after the recording, because we've taken up a lot of Josh's time. So thank you, everybody, for your questions and for joining us for this recording.
Can I ask one question?
Oh, yeah. Yes, please.
Cool. So one of the hurdles for us expanding into Europe will be converting language. And so if anyone wants to volunteer for Humanitix in terms of helping us convert into your local language, if you can drop me an email, josh@humanitix, with the languages you could help us with, or if you know someone who's happy to do that, then I will archive that email and reach out to you when we're ready. That's one of the big barriers, because for us to go into Europe, we need to raise money from philanthropists and start a European charity for Humanitix. Like, we've got an American charity, an Australian charity, a New Zealand charity. And so while the platform will be really good, we have to raise money to grow it in the country. And so anything we can save, including, like, having to translate and all that stuff, or just having friendly faces in the country that can point us in the right direction, would be valuable. Again, we won't be doing that in the next few months, but, like, in the next few years, absolutely.
Yeah, we can.
So just throwing that out there in case anyone is up for that.
Yeah, we can certainly share this with the. I'm sure we can translate to Dutch.
Yeah, okay, cool.
Great. So, yeah, you may be hearing this from your favorite podcast service, or watching this recording on our YouTube channel, or viewing it on our club's website. If you enjoy the program, please share it with a friend, and don't forget to leave a good rating. We really like 5 stars. And if you're inspired to get involved and make a difference in your community, we invite you to learn more about Rotary International and the Rotary Club of Worldwide Impact. So with that, I'd like to thank Josh again for being an amazing guest and for spending time with us today. And I'd like to turn it back to him for one last word. Josh.
Oh, thank you so much for having me here. I've got to speak to a few Rotary clubs in Sydney and a few Rotary Act events. But this is my first online one, and I just love what Rotary does. A lot of shared values with humanities. So yeah, thanks for doing what you do as well. I know, like, I know a lot about what's happened with polio, and you know, some of the amazing stuff Rotary's been involved with. So yeah, thank you.
Thank you again, Josh, and thank you everyone for joining us today. Until next time.